Rideshell. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and the brand new Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. And I've recorded more than 5,500 interviews since 2003, almost all on foreign policy, and all available for you at scotthorton.org. You can sign up for the podcast feed there, and the full interview archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Trita Parsi from the Quincy Institute. And of course, you know, he wrote that great book, Treacherous Alliance, all about America and Israel and Iran and the poor Iraqi stuck in the middle. What a mess. Great book, though. And he's got lots of great opinions about Iranian issues and broader Middle East stuff as well. And happy to have you back on the show. How you doing, Trita?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing good, man. Appreciate you joining us today. So you said a real smart thing in this interview with Al Jazeera here. Sounds a little hyperbolic, but I think maybe I know what you mean. And there's a very interesting couple of points you made about it here. He says, the U.S. is trying to force the Israeli government's collapse. They really want Netanyahu out. Is that right? And for what reason?
I don't know if that's the more hyperbolic piece of what I said. Look, I think it's quite clear. The administration knew very well when they gave that bear hug of Netanyahu that it was a short-term calculation on their end, that Netanyahu invariably would turn around and stab them in the back because he would prefer Trump or a Republican to come back into office. And that despite all of the excessive and wholly unjustified degree of support, at least, that Biden has given Netanyahu and his war efforts in Gaza, Netanyahu would never return the favor, but would betray them. And the preference for the Democratic side, of course, has been not to have Netanyahu in the government. I think the main reason for that is Netanyahu is the Israeli leader that is most comfortable and most capable of interfering in U.S. politics and play domestic American politics against a sitting Democratic president. He did that with Obama. Other Israeli prime ministers are both less capable and less inclined to go that far. And this is a problem that the Democrats have seen for quite some time with Netanyahu. The question, of course, has been, how costly is it to start doing the same thing against Netanyahu and try to get rid of him? And I think the situation in Gaza and the tensions between the Biden administration and Netanyahu, which I don't want to overstate in any way, shape, or form, has nevertheless created a situation combined with the fact that they know that Netanyahu will try to drag out the war and then campaign against Biden in November, has led to a situation in which the administration wants to do something to help compel the collapse of the Israeli government. And also one important factor here to keep in mind is Israeli governments as of late never last particularly long anyways. They have a notoriously divisive political system with a very low bar for groups and parties to enter the Knesset. And you know, they have a parliamentary system, so the prime minister has to keep a majority, so he has to make all kinds of crazy concessions to very small parties in order to keep his coalition in power. So this was going to happen anytime soon anyways, but now it's just politically much more important that it happens soon, I think, from Biden administration's perspective. And you've seen some public things about that, such as, you know, inviting Gantz, inviting Galan to come and meet with officials at the White House. These are people who are in the current government because a war is going on, but otherwise are very bitter political enemies of Netanyahu. So at least there's a soft play that the administration has done. How far they will go with it, I'm not sure. But I do believe that they want to get rid of the Netanyahu government, but it's based on a very dangerous bet, which is the belief that whatever comes next will be less problematic. And I'm not so sure that that actually is the likely outcome.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get back to that in just one second here, but because the point is not that the Democrats, especially the ones in charge, disagree with the policy or give a damn at all, right? They're just worried about votes coming up here because it's an election year. But
well, so I mean, the to question the extent is, that they disagree with the policy, I would like to see them do something about it. And I'm not seeing that. So
okay, well,
I think at least it's
right.
It's safe to assume that it's not problematic enough for them to do something about it.
Right. But so this is essentially a stunt, like a PR thing to try to get Democrat voters to think, well, geez, at least he's a little less worse than Trump and them on the issue, that kind of thing. But and I mean, that must be the case, right? I mean, they coordinated this thing with Charles Schumer giving that speech in the Senate, and it's very political what they're doing there, trying to hedge their bets. But one, doesn't it seem too late for that in terms of Democratic politics in America? And two, never even mind too late for it. That is never going to work when it comes to world opinion and how bad things have shifted against Israel just in the last few months here, right?
I mean, remember, every time there has been a labor president that has come to power or a non-Likud prime minister has come to power in Israel, there has been an effort to portray that person as a peacemaker and a visionary, all of these different things to essentially justify an American policy that is completely deferential to Israel when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as well as on many other issues, but particularly on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I'm not saying that there isn't a difference between Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak and others. And certainly with Shimon Peres and others, there certainly are differences, but it is overstated for political purposes. And in this case, they will try it. They will try it in order to reduce the pressure that exists on the Democrats from their own base about Israeli politics. But to just give you an example, when Gantz was running against Netanyahu a couple of years ago for the prime ministership position, which he lost, one of his campaign videos was just a long video of devastation in Gaza as a result, if I'm not mistaken, of the war in 2014 and the devastation the Israelis wreaked on Gaza back then through mm-hmm. their massive bombings, which Gantz put out there as something that he bragged about, something
yeah, he
that
said,
justified him being prime minister.
Yeah, he said he bombed him back to the Stone Age.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, many of their statements are the ones that the South Africans have been citing in their genocide case. So there's a self-serving desire to try to overstate the differences between them, because of the manner that Netanyahu is willing to support Republicans against Democrats in the U.S., not necessarily because their actual policies in the West Bank, in Gaza, towards the Palestinians, towards the region, is necessarily that different. I mean, these are all people that are part of the war cabinet right now. They are as responsible for the war crimes, the indiscriminate bombing, and perhaps, as may be concluded, the genocide that Israel is committing right now. In Israel. And to just pin that on Netanyahu, not that he doesn't deserve a lot of blame for it, but just to pin it solely on him, that's a political maneuver that is just completely self-serving, is not having any particularly strong relationship with reality.
Yeah. Hey, and speaking of cynical moves here, what about making a big deal of abstaining on the UN resolution and then turning around and publicly announcing this one's non-binding, even though it doesn't say that? And look, I'm an anti-one world commie here, but the hypocrisy is just insane. As Donald Trump might say, in public relations terms, it looks really shallow and even stupid and horrible, right?
Well, I would say it's worse than that, because here's a resolution. First of all, just on the technicality, this is a Chapter 6 resolution, which means that it is binding, but compared to a Chapter 7 resolution, that's when the UN would have a resolution like this may contain language to say that the use of force is also authorized in order to force the compliance with the resolution. So think Saddam invading Kuwait in 1991 and the resolution that was passed then. So, yes, this is not a Chapter 7 resolution, doesn't have an arms embargo, sanctions, or certainly no authorization of use of force, but it is nevertheless binding under Chapter 6. And the US side knows this very, very well. This is all about how they're trying to do something to essentially go along with or allow a ceasefire to be passed in the Security Council because it's been so costly for them to, and so damaging to the US to have vetoed three of them already. But then on the other hand, say things in order to minimize any damage that this may have caused in the US-Israel relationship, because that is their top priority for reasons that I think are quite flawed. Because you could see it afterwards, Kirby was saying that, you know, Netanyahu is trying to create the perception that there is daylight between the US and Israel. There should be daylight between the US and Israel, mindful of the war crimes that Israel is committing right now. There should be daylight. And the fact that you're doing everything you can to pretend that there isn't or ensuring there isn't, that's the problem. That really is the problem. But the bigger missed opportunity there is that, you know, this abstention allowed there to be a bit of a reduction of tensions between the US and every other state in the Security Council. And then they turned around and ruined it by making these false statements that this is not binding. They're essentially signaling the US is not going to do anything to make sure that this is enforced. And the thing that is really fascinating about that, it means that the call or the demand for the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages held by Hamas is also then not binding. Why would you say that?
Because they don't give a damn. That's why. Man. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Let me tell you about Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. Who knew? Artificial bank credit expansion leads to price inflation and terribly distorted markets. If you've got any savings left at all, you need to protect them. You need to put some, at least, into precious metals. Well, Roberts & Roberts can set you up with the best deals on silver, gold, platinum, and palladium. And they've been doing this since 1977. Hey, if you just need some sound advice about sound money, they're there for you too. Call Tim Fry and the guys at 800-874-9760. That's 800-874-9760. Or check them out at rrbi.co. That's rrbi.co. You'll be glad you did. Hey, y'all, you should sign up for my Substack. It's scotthortonshow.substack.com. And if you do that, you'll get the interviews a day before everybody else. But not only that, they'll be free of commercials. How do you like that? Pretty good, huh? scotthortonshow.substack.com. Hey, y'all, libertasbella.com is where you get Scott Horton Show and Libertarian Institute shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, and stickers and things, including the great Top Lobsters designs as well. See, that way it says on your shirt why you're so smart. Libertas Bella, from the same great folks who bring you ammo.com for all your ammunition needs, too. That's libertasbella.com.
Yeah, it's completely crazy what they're doing here. There's a great little Substack went out from MJ Rosenberg today where he's talking about these soldiers who are kidnapped and held by Hamas now and how their families are protesting. And I think it was his title or maybe it was the article he was citing that loyalty to Israel is a one-way street. They don't give a damn about the people who serve them at all, clearly, much less their enemies. But anyway, okay, politics inside the Democratic Party, though, it's really unique this year. I mean, it's been going more and more this way. But the polls have 77% of Democrats are against this right now and with fervor, right? This is one of their big issues this year because, well, they're on the internet and can see what's happening. And so they're very upset. And so all the old guys are, you know, Biden-esque Zionists and worse up there. And so there's this huge crack up. And I guess the contest always is, how to keep all the voters sheepdogged enough? How do you get, you know, Bernie Sanders or some kind of, you know, Hollywood environmentalist or somebody to convince people to still vote Democrat for him? But are they going to be able to pull that off all the way to November here? It doesn't look like it. You know, if I think you and I talked about this 10 years ago. Obama is JFK. That makes Biden LBJ, right? In other words, he's ugly and gross, and young kids don't like him the way that they liked his predecessor.
Yeah, I mean, the young kids were never passionate or excited about Biden. They voted for him despite of Biden. They voted against Trump. And they were led to be convinced, and perhaps it was true at the time, that he was the one who had the best shot at beating Trump. That argument, I don't think, is going to be in any way, shape, or form as effective this year as it was in 2020. It's still going to have an impact on some folks, without a doubt. But when you're seeing the Atlantic Monthly running an article today, if the headline, if I remember correctly, said something that, you know, Israel is at this point indefensible. It's indefensible to support Israel at this point. If you've lost the Atlantic Monthly, what do you think you've done with the Gen Z folks then?
Wow, yeah, I hadn't seen that one.
Yeah, so I think pushing the idea that you know, Trump is worse, et cetera, is going to have an impact. It's going to have a certain degree. The question is, did he even have close to having the margins to be able to lose these people? And the White House, in my read and my conversations, et cetera, were almost arrogant about this 2 or so months ago. Then Michigan happened. The uncommitted vote happened. It spread. And I think at this point, they're near panicking because they realize that they actually don't have the situation under control and they don't know how to get it back into control. Just allowing, I mean, even if the abstention was supposed to be something they did in order to reduce the pressure and kind of win back some of their own base, they ruined that too with all of these statements that is non-binding. So I really don't think they know what they're doing at this point. They lost control. They know it. They have not managed to regain control. And their only bet, I think, at this point is to make sure that Trump himself does something to self-implode, because their own ability to actually win back people. And I've had conversations with folks from the Democratic Party who try to make the arguments, and it's just stunning to see how tone deaf their arguments are, how they've profoundly misread their own base, not understanding why they feel this way, not understanding that they're seeing things that the average American who only watches TV and mainstream TV is not seeing. They're not getting that. And they're not getting the fact that this is not, I mean, the fact that they're going out there saying that those voters would be single vote issues, or what is it called, single issue voters. In the minds of a lot of people, this is a genocide. So yes, that is gonna be an issue that trumps everything else, particularly mindful of the fact that the United States, thanks to Biden, is complicit in it.
Yeah. All right. So what are the chances of the war in Lebanon getting much worse? Sorry to ask you to make a prediction, but it seems like that's the real danger, next step in regional war, if we're going to have one.
So this goes to a larger question of, if Biden is trying to get rid of Netanyahu, how is Netanyahu going to react to it? On the one hand, I think Netanyahu actually welcomes having this fight with Biden. It plays well for him, he believes, internally. It also moves him further to the right. But one of the things that he may actually do as a result of all of this, and I'm not saying that he wouldn't have done it anyways, but it may actually happen sooner than otherwise, is to actually ramp up things militarily, both in Gaza, perhaps going into Rafah, but also with Lebanon. And there is a concern right now. It's been going up and down. It's been more intense at certain moments and then less, but it's going up now again, because there seems to be a pattern now which the Israelis are not just bombing Lebanon. They are targeting paramedics. They seem to be really angling to get a strong response from Hezbollah and then use that as a pretext to launch a larger war with Lebanon, which would be a devastating war, of course. And the administration has said from the outset that that is something that they've been trying to push Netanyahu not to do. which may be a reason for Netanyahu to do it, because he wants to show that Biden cannot tell me what to do or not to do. But it will be devastating. It will be further devastating for Biden. His base will lose further hope and faith in him, because Biden will have utterly failed to contain the indiscriminate bombings in Gaza, and now the war has further expanded. Once that happens, you're also probably going to see a breakdown of this uneasy truce that seems to exist right now, in which the Iraqi and Syrian militias for now have stopped attacking U.S. troops.
Yeah, and it was the Ayatollah who asked them to knock it off, and that would probably be canceled. I think also there's a real question of, if you take the stories from leading up to October the 7th, where the consensus inside the IDF and whatever Israeli security forces was, Hamas are a bunch of punks. They're not going to do anything. We're not worried about them. Now, Hezbollah, those guys know how to fight, and they got a lot of missiles nowadays, and this kind of thing. We've got to be careful about that. But anyway, so that's the part of the story to focus on is Hezbollah is not Hamas. And they have not been locked in a concentration camp this whole time or under occupation in the last 20 years. And I know Israel bombs the hell out of their guys receiving weapons in Syria pretty often, but they seem to continue to receive them anyway. And in 2006, they did a hell of a job fighting the Israelis to a stalemate and a reversal over, what, 4 weeks in the summer of 06 there in July? So
it was a humiliating defeat for the Israelis back in 2006.
And it doesn't look like the IDF has gotten a lot stronger and more capable.
No, the battlefield has evened out in comparison, because now you have drones and other cheap but very efficient technologies that were not a big part of the picture back then. And the Israeli approach is going to be very similar to what they've done in Gaza, which is just, you know, carpet bombing the place, which of course will cause a tremendous, tremendous amount of human suffering again.
I worry that they would need B-52s to carpet bomb the place with the kind of carpet bombing that they would require to take out all those missiles. And Israel doesn't have B-52s.
Yeah, I mean, the Israelis know. One number I heard from an Israeli expert is that their own estimation is that there will be about 40,000 casualties on the Israeli side in a full-scale war with Hezbollah.
Yeah. Well,
so it's obviously a very, very devastating war for the Israelis as well. But Netanyahu, let's also be frank, you know, he needs these things to stay in power, and he needs to stay in power in order to stay out of jail.
Yeah.
And he also has then increasingly right-wing fanatic voter base. That so far is quite thrilled, not only with what is happening in Gaza, but who believes that it's not gone far enough, that are pushing him to go into Rafah, and who have also favored a war with Lebanon. And the narrative there, of course, is precisely because Hezbollah is way more powerful than Hamas. Imagine if Hezbollah were to try to pull off what Hamas did on October 7th. It would be far more devastating. And as a result, it is not tolerable to live next to Hezbollah. You have no choice but to have that war. And it's better to have that war on our choosing when it comes to the timing, rather than on Hezbollah's choosing of timing.
The Bush doctrine and the Netanyahu doctrine. Which is the chicken and which is the egg?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your time, Trita. I really appreciate you coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.